It's a cold night all over. People listening to Coast AM snuggled up warm, I hope. If you don't have one of those calamity kits from Sea Crane, you really ought to look at getting one of those. On a night like this, when the power can drop out, not just in areas that are used to getting cold and snow, but areas like Seattle, which I was hearing a little bit about earlier today, getting hit pretty hard, closing off roads because the hills are too steep and accidents were being caused just by people who are just trying to go down the hills, not to mention going up the hills. That's even scarier. You get halfway up a hill and your wheels start to slide backward, even though you're tapping the gas to go forward. You just keep going backward. That's nothing scarier than that. But we hope you're warm and safe, and so is everybody you know, and that if you're catching Coast to Coach tonight, you're not catching a cold while you're listening. The shoveling can wait until tomorrow. Wait till the wind stops blowing so hard. I've got 25-mile-per-hour gusts here in the upper Midwest. Our air temperature is negative 10, which means that as we speak, I'm sitting in the danger part of the chart. It's negative 37 outside of the window here of the studio where I'm broadcasting, and that just enters into the zone where you will get frostbite within 10 minutes if you step outside on any exposed flesh. Frostbite will begin to occur within 10 minutes. Go a few more degrees, and it'll start to happen in 5 minutes. It's that cold out. And so for any area that is under the weather, so to speak, we wish you the best in getting through this period. It looks like a couple of days yet before these waves will pass over entirely. Maybe right around Christmas, it'll start to warm up again. But again, this is why we're giving you such a great show tonight, that you can stay inside and think about the upcoming year. Think about the creation of ideas, ideas that create wealth, ideas that change the world. And that's what we're going to talk about with Guy Kawasaki coming up in just a second. He's studied world-changing ideas, both how they have happened, how they are happening now, and where they are waiting for us next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Guy Kawasaki is the author of many business books, going back a few years to talking about his life with Macintosh. The book, The Macintosh Way, I think is the first book that people get to know Guy Kawasaki for. And good evening, Guy Kawasaki. I love the new book, Reality Check.
Thank you very much.
I regret that I only got it just the other day. So unlike my usual protocol of having read the book cover to cover before I interview somebody, I'm catching you a little bit unprepared. But
I'll help you fake it.
I love what you do. And I will read this book because I am fascinated with this subject. And it's something we've talked about a lot on Coast to Coast over the years. But I would say then, our time we're going to spend together may be more about your blog than your book, more about your personal life than your business success. But we'll get into that because the new book, great primer, obviously lots of good anecdotes, very well-reviewed book for people who are looking for ways to be more competitive. But I think it's more interesting, that part of you that is focused on how to change the world. That's the name of your blog, right?
Yes.
All right. And the idea of idea creation, and where does it come from? How is it nurtured? How are good ideas born? Where are they born, and how they, the potential that they have if they're given the right care and feeding? I love that. And I love looking at it both historically and also projecting into the future. Are you good with that?
Yes, absolutely. You want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. First of all, let me tell you, I love my Mac.
You do?
I totally, and I don't know why I spent so much time with Windows and a PC. I should have gone Mac a long time ago. I am what you, I believe, get credited for terming an evangelist.
You are. Good for you.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, why is Mac better?
Well, you tell people all the time?
Yeah, I tell you, why is Mac better? You tell me.
Okay, I get it. Well, fundamentally, Macintosh, people come to view their Macintoshes as an extension of themselves that makes them more creative or more productive. Whereas with other operating systems, you very seldom hear of a person referring to his or her Windows or Vista machine as an extension of themselves, and that it makes them more creative or productive. So there's this great affinity between Macintosh owners and their Macs, because we think it makes us more creative and productive, whereas, shall I say, with other operating systems, you may be fighting it all the time.
Yeah,
it's kind of
definitely
a different attitude.
Yeah, I think my old and I had a laptop, and it got the job done barely. I had to sometimes, you know, I had to restart a bunch of times sometimes to get one project finished. So it became sort of an extension of my frustration with life in general. It became sort of a metaphor for my frustrations with life. Whereas the Mac thing becomes, it's like a big complicated pen at the end of my fingers. You know, I feel like I have a lot more autonomy with it.
Yeah. Thank God for Steve Jobs. You know, I mean, it's all his vision.
Well, but you went to work there at a fairly early point in the career of Mac, right? I mean, how long had Mac been started before you went to work for Macintosh?
Well, the Macintosh product was being worked on for about 2 years. I joined in late 1983. The Macintosh was announced on January 24th, 1984. So I had been there about 4 months before it shipped, and then I stayed there for about 3 years before I went off to start a Macintosh software company.
And you've started lots of companies, and that may pop up throughout the interview. I know you are regarded as sort of a venture capitalist as well as a writer, and you are in the creation of products as well as writing about the creation of products. Is that fair?
Yes. I wear many hats. I am a venture capitalist. I am a blogger, a writer, speaker, and I'm also an entrepreneur. I have a website called AllTop where we aggregate news on about 400 topics. So for people who are trying to find news on the internet, you know, if you type any given term into Google, you get a mere 35 million hits.
Right.
So that's not too effective for most people. So, for example, you a Mac fan, we have a page called mac.alltop.com. And at mac.alltop.com, we aggregate all the Macintosh news. That's the only place you need to go to stay on top of Macintosh.
Okay. Love that. And we'll get to the future and future technology and great ideas and how does magic happen and all this coming up in just a second. But why is Windows better known and bigger still? If Macintosh works better, and I have to say it does, and I know there's lots of Windows people that are like, oh, got another Mac idiot out there talking about it. But why is Windows still bigger if Mac works better?
You know, I've been thinking about that for about 34 years now. And I don't know. I mean, one of the lessons I learned that I absolutely included in my book is that the better product doesn't necessarily win. You know, there are many things that are suboptimal, such as, for example, the keyboard that we all use, this QWERTY keyboard.
Right.
In a sense, when they were making typewriters, you know, the manual typewriters, well,
right,
if you got to be too fast a typist,
it jammed up.
Yeah, it jammed it up. So they made the keyboard suboptimal on purpose. And now when there's, you know, no pieces of metal flying and jamming, we're still stuck with that. So that's another example of, I mean, imagine if you made another keyboard and everywhere you look is a QWERTY keyboard. I mean, wouldn't that drive you crazy? And
I've heard that, you know, and it's true. I mean, the reason they said they designed it was so that nobody could type that fast, and therefore that's why it was a hit. But, I'm of those that believe that you could rearrange the letters in any order. It wouldn't matter. We'll eventually learn. And that it doesn't really, I mean, you learn, your fingers learn. How many words can you type per minute if they changed the way the letters were? It's not significant to me. I think what's more interesting to me anyway to think about when it comes to keyboards is that I think some of the designs where you bend the keyboard so that it's not straight, I thought that was an interesting innovation. To me, the order of the letters didn't matter so much as the ergonomics of how keyboards were set up.
Well, but to take this to an extreme, have you watched some of these teenagers text message their phones? My God. I mean,
true. See, but that proves my point.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
They're just like, I mean, the number of teenagers who, if you say, a number, they can immediately tell you what letter values that number has.
Yeah.
Right? They could say right away which letters. I couldn't do that now.
Oh,
and I've been.
I'll tell you a funny story. So exactly what you said. I was in London a few years ago, and I go to an ATM because I need to get some pounds, right?
Right.
And on the London ATM, the bank's keypad, they don't have the letters. They only have 1234567890. And so I've memorized my password in terms of letters, not numbers. So I'm sitting
right
there, and I'm like, what the hell is my password? And I'm trying to like, okay, so one is ABC, two is, and it, I never got any pounds.
You never got any pounds. You're poundless.
I'm poundless.
I'm sorry to hear that. Well, then back to the main subject, and I may digress back into a Windows discussion along the way, and I don't want it to. I don't want this whole thing to break down into an Apple versus Windows thing. But I will tell you, I used to come on the air routinely on Coast to Coast after some frustrating experience and when I went Mac a year ago, I have no computer anxiety whatsoever. Even when the other day my hard drive failed on my Mac laptop, which I'm told like never happens, right? And there's all that, but I was covered under warranty. They fixed it. I have time capsule, so I have automatic backup.
Yeah.
So from hard drive failure at noon, I was back up and running with all of my original settings and everything that was in the system by 5 o'clock that afternoon.
Really?
And I thought, yeah, that was within 5 hours.
Did you go to a store and get your hard drive swapped out?
Yep. Yep, I live right near the Mall of America, so I went over to the Genius Bar there, and they flipped it in, the new one. I got it back in an hour and a half, and I backed it up with the time capsule, and within 5 hours of total hard drive failure, it was like it never happened. It was like waving a magic wand.
I tell you what, the next time my Mac breaks, I'm going to FedEx it to you. You take it in for me. Okay?
Yeah, I'm telling you, and I got no special treatment. It just I didn't. They're busy as heck because everybody's buying stuff at the Mac store for Christmas. It just happened to be, and I thought, okay, but that's really cool to me. That never would have happened with my old PC. But anyway, all right, So what I love is, and I'm always trying to figure out why an idea works.
Okay.
And I liken it all the time. I watch really bad movies all the time.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious how a great director, a good writer, and famous stars can make such crap. And, like, where does it break down?
Don't forget the big amount of money they throw in.
Yeah, exactly. How does it break down? You've got all of this talent, and it end up with this crummy product. And I'm so curious, like, okay, what went wrong? Why did it go south? You know, what was it? And so I'm always trying to figure out, sort of retroactively figure out, like, what happened. So let's work the other way around. You worked with Apple from the ground up and some of the other things. How does a great idea happen? Where does the magic happen in an idea?
Okay, I have two data points for you. So first of all, I think that great ideas happen when people ask a very simple question, which is, wouldn't it be neat if?
Yep.
Okay, wouldn't it be neat if I could have my own personal computer? Wouldn't it be neat if there were a better search engine? Wouldn't it be neat if I could sell used printers online to other people around the world? Because I just described Apple and eBay, right, and Google. And, you know, wouldn't it be neat if I could upload video that I stole so that other people can watch it, and every once in a while someone will make a video of people dropping Diet Mentos into Diet Cokes? That
right
describes YouTube.
Right.
So a lot of people, they like over-intellectualize this. You know, they're saying like, well, I looked at the market research, and according to Forrester and Jupiter, the worldwide market for dog food being sold online is $20 billion. So I'm going to make a dogfood.com.
Right.
And, you know, they don't own a dog. They never have owned a dog. They don't know how to kill a cow and put it in a can and get it to the dog. But they read some report that it's a $20 billion business. So because, you know, they have an MBA and they work for Lehman Brothers as an investment banker, now they decided, yeah, I'm going to tap the dog food business.
Right.
That's the company that fails.
So, okay, so that's my movie analogy then, right? That's when you get your big stars together with a big director and a big budget, and they still come up with a crappy movie. Now, that's great. Now, how does an idea work? Somebody says, all right, wouldn't it be neat if, and still, there's a million people out there that are driving along, and they go, wouldn't it be neat if,
yeah.
But they still can't pull it off into a blockbuster movie, so to speak.
Well, some of it is because many people may ask the question, wouldn't it be neat if, but not that many try it. And so, at the beginning of my career, I used to think that the idea is the key, and once you get a good idea, implementation is easy.
Right.
Now I'm at the end of my career, and I believe exactly the opposite. I think good ideas are easy, and implementation is hard. So, you know, how many people are listening to this right now? A few million? I'll give you all a great idea, okay?
Yeah.
The idea is you make an operating system for computers that is fast, elegant, beautiful, and bug-free. That is a multi-billion dollar idea. The problem is nobody can do it. And so my lesson in life is you ask this question, wouldn't it be neat if? And then if you have the courage to quit your job, drop out, do whatever it is to try it, that's what it takes. And I think the same thing is true for movies or books. You know, you just have to give it a shot. In my career, I've noticed that the people who are successful as venture capitalists and successful as entrepreneurs, one of the greatest correlating factors is luck.
Yeah. It's funny. Even as you said that, I was thinking to myself, but where does luck come into it? Because there's that other piece that often happens where somebody is kind of, they're standing on a corner waiting for a bus to come by, and it's not a bus, it's suddenly a convertible with somebody with a trunk full of money, and it changes everything.
Yeah, you know, Bill Gates, the Microsoft, if Gary Kildall and the people at Digital Research, this is going way back, had been nicer to the people at IBM, IBM would have gone with CPM as their operating system, and Bill Gates today would be working in Starbucks making cappuccinos. So, you know, how do you account for that? Now, this is not to say Bill Gates is not a smart guy and he didn't work hard and all that, but, you know, at some point, these little flips of fate help you.
Right. You know, we talk a little bit about luck on this show. It's sort of one of the threads that has gone through the show over the years I've been involved, because it's so elusive and yet it's so powerful when it happens. And the discussion often comes down to making one's own luck. Is that an experience you've had of making your own luck?
Well, I'd like to believe that. I think some people just are lucky. They didn't make it. Now, you know, all these entrepreneurs work hard, and I will tell you one thing for sure. If you are an entrepreneur or a venture capitalist and you are lucky and you make this enormous success, retroactively, you never attribute it to luck. You say you were smart, you worked hard, you had a brilliant insight, you're a visionary. Nobody stands up and says, yeah, I'm successful because of luck. Now, you know, some of that is just human nature, right?
Right.
But, yeah, boy,
well,
I'd rather be lucky than smart, Ian.
Well, I understand that, but making your own luck is something I'll throw at you here. It's something I've been making notes on for years, and what does it mean to make one's own luck? And I think that there's at least a piece of that's true. All right, so then coming up then here with Guy Kawasaki, his new book is called Reality Check, and he's a great business book writer, but we're talking a little bit more mystically about creativity. So I want to get back to the magic.
Okay.
The magic of an idea, of a world-changing idea. So let's get maybe into some of the specifics about Mac or some of the other things you've studied, which were world-changing ideas. Plus, I want to ask you to profile the person most likely to have a world-changing idea.
Okay.
We'll pick it up there coming up next with Guy Kawasaki on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If you're one of the many who believe that the world will end in 2012, on December 21st 2012, then consider the date that is about to happen on the West Coast time zone here in just a minute, the Pacific time zone, and then, of course, a couple hours later than that in Hawaii, but has already dawned, obviously, on the East and the Midwest and in mountain time. We are already into December 21st, 2008. Now, if we assume that the Mayans were able to take into consideration the four-year time gap between the Western calendar and the Mayan calendar, if we assume that they somehow knew that there was a four-year difference, then we aren't at doomsday yet. But if we consider that the Mayans would not have been able to calculate 2012 in the Mayan calendar, with, you know, knowing that the Western calendar was off by 4 years, as we know now to be the case, marking the birth of Christ 4 years wrong, then technically it is already 2012, as we've discussed a couple of times on Coast to Coast. In fact, it's already December 21st, 2012, with the four-year difference factored in. How's it going so far in your doomsday? We'll keep an eye on it. Who knows? We may not be able to finish this show. More with Guy Kawasaki coming up. We'll talk about idea creation. And assuming we live through this this date in history, then what will the future be like? What about future technology? And what? Where is that next Mac? Where is that next Windows program coming from? Who's going to create it? What's the profile of the world changers that are out there? Could you be one of them? And what things might be in the pipeline now that'll change the world next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Guy Kawasaki, the author of Reality Check, it's his latest business book. We're talking about idea creation, world-changing ideas, how they, where do they come from, and how do they work? Why do some work and others don't, amongst other topics? But I want to identify what might seem like a cultural bias. Okay, I had neighbors who were the woman was from Japan. She was married to an American. And so you, as a Japanese American, maybe I'm making a connection here. She was obsessed with luck. My Japanese neighbor, she used to talk about luck all the time. And in a sense that she thought it was totally random, that there were certain things you could do that could increase your luck, but it was only in terms of almost like inviting the gods or the fates to make you more lucky. Because if something happened or we got something, she used to always say it, and my wife and I still say it to each other because she was so sweet about it, but she would say, "You're so lucky. You're so," like we used to think, we didn't feel lucky, and it felt like something we, you know, that kind of came about through other means, but she always identified those things as luck. Are you chiming with that, or is that not part of your upbringing too?
You know, I'm Japanese-American, but I'm third generation, so you know, I'm as honky as you are. So
it's all gone, huh? Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
You know, the only thing I still do is eat fish raw. That's about it.
And now I do that too. So what the heck? So
you're turning Japanese.
Well, not at the moment, but catch me in the next break. So, here's my question, and it goes back to the luck making idea. Is I think that there are things which we do that maximize our success, which seem random in their payoff. You can't tell when they're going to pay off, but it's a little bit like working a slot machine. You put in, you know, 12 hours shoveling quarters into some one-armed bandit, and at some point, it's going to start, it may pay off. Now, it may, the payoff for you, or if you walk away, it may pay off to the lucky schlub that comes right behind you and just shoves a quarter in it. Just at that time, it was going to pay off for you. But I think, to me, that's a lot about what luck is. It's all about preparation and then being there for when that preparation pays off.
Well, but I think you're stretching the applicability of luck to entrepreneurship. So, you know, definitely Bill Gates was lucky that Gary Kildall and Digital Research didn't take care of IBM. But once that luck occurred, he still could have blown it. So, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, they had the fortune of creating this personal computer, and HP and Atari weren't interested in it at the time, so they went and created, you know, Apple itself. That was, in a sense, a lucky move. But once, you know, you can be lucky and still screw up. You have to be lucky and then work hard and actually build the computer or build the operating system. So there's ways to increase your luck.
Right. But that's making...
Go ahead. One way is to just work so damn hard.
Right.
It's all about implementation.
Well, see, but I think even there, and I think this is where some people take a stab at something, it doesn't pay off, and they quit. And I think that part of what has been fortunate about my career is when opportunities came up, an opportunity that others might have missed because they lacked preparation, I was able to take advantage of. For them, it was not luck. For them, they don't even know it as luck.
Yeah.
They don't even see, because it was just an opportunity that came and went. And for me, I was able to take advantage of something that came up, and that's why it looks lucky. Because it was like you're the right person at the right place at the right time, but that being the right person and being at the right place is what it's all about. The time part you might not have been able to handle, but those other two increase your chance for success.
Well, you know, the other thing, Ian, you should be cognizant of is at the moment that you're lucky, you don't really know it. You know, many companies start off saying, I'm going to build this.
Right.
For some unforeseen reason, they change it and build something else, and that turns into a success. I think the majority of companies that were successful started off with a completely different model, completely different market. You know, Google started off, they wanted to basically be a sort of high-end consulting firm to help people with their search engines, not to be a destination search engine themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, you look back and you say, wow, you know, thank God we made that decision. But at the time you make that decision, you have no idea.
Right.
Basically, entrepreneurship is all about thrashing. And you just thrash, and sometimes you hit it.
Yeah, I totally chime with that.
So people like me, you know, I write reality check based on my experiences in the past 30 years so that when you make this decision and you try and you need a reference guide about, you know, how to recruit and how to build a product and how to support your customers, at that point, even if you're lucky, it would be beneficial if you're not flying blind. I mean, why make the same mistakes? So that's what my book is trying to do. It's a reference guide. It's not a read once, get inspired, and never pick it up again. It's more like a recipe book than anything else.
Right. So love that. You know, don't get me wrong. Now, let's go back in time a little bit then to your past models of idea creation. How did the magic happen for Mac? How did the planets line up to make Mac a success?
Well, you know, 90% of this discussion is about Steve Jobs, right? So Steve Jobs is one of the few people you can say truly is a visionary. And everybody throws around the V word. You know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry Web 2.0 clown says they're a visionary. So as a good guide for you is, if someone labels themselves or calls themselves a visionary, they're probably a clown. So Steve Jobs saw that user interfaces needed to be better. He saw that design still matters to a small part of the world. He saw that ease of use was the key, and he went for it. And, you know, you could make the argument that anybody could have done it. Xerox PARC could have done it, but they didn't go for it. Other people could have visited Xerox PARC and been inspired by the icons and graphical user interface and do it, and they didn't. So Steve Jobs is one of a handful of visionaries. I don't consider myself a visionary, for example. I have no clue about what's happening in the future. I'm a marketing person. Hopefully, if you present me with a vision of the future, I can tell if I can sell it. But I can't invent the future. And, you know, most people in Silicon Valley are delusional that way. They think they can invent the future.
So how does the future happen, in your opinion?
It happens by accident. It happens by the law of big numbers. It happens by an infinite number of monkeys pounding on keyboards, and one of them is going to hit Beethoven's fifth. It's the law of big numbers. And that's one of the beauties. You know, everybody says, oh, the whole dot-com thing was just a big farce, and look at all the money that was wasted, et cetera, et cetera. But that was just a big biological explosion of all different forms of life. Some forms of life, like WebVan, died. Some forms of life, like Amazon, survived and thrived. At the time you created a WebVan, or at the other extreme, Amazon.com, you know, you were fairly intelligent. You didn't put money into WebVan thinking, oh, this is a dumbass idea, I'll fund it anyway. You thought that was going to be successful too. And it's only looking backwards that you can say, oh, Amazon was smart, WebVan was stupid. And that's sort of the challenge of venture capital. The way venture capital works, you make 20 bets, one or two are successful. You say, oh, I knew that team was good. I knew that technology was good. I knew that market was good. I knew that business model was good. That's why I invested in that company. And somebody asks you, well, what about the other 18 bets that you made that all were losers? What you do is you say, hey, I didn't vote for those deals. My partners did those. That's how it works.
Okay, well, that I'll draw a parallel to what I do, which is fail a lot, and I fail a lot at a lot of things, but I'm really good with failure, so it doesn't bother me. But I know that when people come up to me and they say, "Oh, I love that thing you did," and fill in the blank on whatever it is of the many things that I do in a week, and someone will say, "Oh, I just love that." And I find myself drawn to explaining, taking all the fun out of it. I'll explain how that was exactly the same model I used for the 20 other things I did last week that failed.
Yeah.
And that it just so happened that this one worked. And maybe I had no idea that that one was going to be more successful over another. I'll give you just an example is I write a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
And I think the same, you know, classic tools that I use to make a joke on Tuesday, which nobody laughed at, which I thought was hysterical. I used the same tools to do a joke on Thursday, which I thought was pretty routine, kind of a throwaway, that everybody went, oh, my God, that was great. And I think, you know, that's how I think of it. Is that kind of roughly how where you are with that?
Well, I have two words for you. And the two words are declare victory. So whenever you hit one out of the park, you just declare victory, man. Don't be shy about it. And the flip side of declaring victory is you ignore and you forget about your failures.
But I'm fascinated with the failure. That's how we started this conversation. I love the process, and I'm really curious how process works. And you know, I'll take a bow now and again, but most of the time, I'm really conscious of how much I fail. And I'm sort of intrigued by it because somehow I managed to keep evolving.
I think it's a Minnesota thing. You think you are thinking. You know why? Because it's so damn cold in Minnesota. You
it is.
All the time. All you do is thinking.
It's negative 10 like outside right now.
You know, we're not indoors all the time. We have
That's lives. Right. Hey, we're outdoors.
Can
don't
I
get
funny wait, wait. Minnesota?
Wait, hold on, guy. Yeah. We're outdoors all day long. We just have to be bundled up. But yeah, go ahead. Tell me about Minnesota.
So I'm from Hawaii.
Right.
And about 6 years ago, I took up hockey because my kids took up hockey. And I never
you
skated.
Rock.
I never skated till I was 48 years old. Okay. So 48 years old, imagine going on the ice for the first time in skates, right?
Well, that was like 6 years ago.
Yeah. And right. So 6 years ago, I started hockey, never skated in my life. And you're from Minnesota, so you know that you're supposed to start skating at 2, not 48.
Right.
Right. So I'm like 46 years behind schedule. And so I really fall in love with hockey. I mean, I play every day now. Literally every day. So these good Minnesotans, they invite me to the Minnesota Outdoor Pond Hockey Championship tournament on Lake Nononina or Nikonono or Nokonono or whatever.
Nokomis. Lake Nokomis.
Yeah, that.
I know just where it is, right?
All right, so you know, how hard could this be? So you go out there, and there's this freaking frozen lake, and there's 20 little rinks made, and you have to scrape the thing with the shovel before it is 20 degrees below zero.
Right.
And you got all these Minnehutans who have been playing hockey since the age of 2.
Right.
And I'm like, I guarantee you, I'm the only Hawaiian out there. It was an eye-opening experience. And then I I've never returned to Minnesota after that experience.
You didn't come back for the ice fishing? You didn't come back for that?
No. I saw Grumpy Old Man. There's no way.
And so, it was filmed on Lake Nokomis, too.
That's my Minnesota story. And, in fact, my wife is from Minnesota.
Is she really whereabouts?
I don't know, near a lake. I don't know.
Well, you can pretty much throw a bowling ball and hit a lake around here.
That narrows it down.
Yeah, not really. But, you know, it's so interesting you say that, because I think that that the pond hockey paradigm is something that escapes a lot of people. You know,
from Hawaii, for sure.
No, but even go south two states, and the idea of pond hockey is kind of a bizarre thought for a lot of people. And we say in Minnesota it's the land of 10,000 rinks, right?
Yeah.
Because and yet here there hasn't been the kind of deep freeze that the culture depended on to be able to maintain that. And there has been this sort of cultural shift. People who are native, and I'm not native to Minnesota, but the native especially, it's been too warm, and it really kind of throws off their life cycle when it's too warm, and it doesn't really, you don't get a really hard freeze where you can play hockey on the ice until February. It's been wrong. Something's been wrong. And so this year, because it's so...
That's because all the people in California are buying Humvees.
So we should say thank you then. Well, so back to the idea then of idea creation, because I think this is interesting as we're looking ahead. You say you're not a trend watcher or a visionary, but let me ask you, I mean, where do you think the magic is happening right now for the new ideas that's going to change the world, that are going to change the world in 2009, 10, and beyond?
Well, you know, ageist as this may seem, I think the richest vein is in engineering schools. And, you know, whether it's MIT, Stanford, University of Minnesota, Carnegie Mellon, you know, University of Wisconsin,
right,
whatever it is, it's the engineering school. Because in an engineering school, you have these nerdy people who, they don't know what they don't know, which is good. If you know what you don't know, you know, then pretty soon you get all these fears and you get these complexes. Like you're always worried about failure.
Not worried, just aware. Not worried, okay, aware.
Well, awareness is a bad thing. You need to be totally blind to failure and just go for it.
Okay.
And so typically it's because, I'll give you a very good example. So I evangelized the Macintosh operating system. I can tell you how hard it is to convince software companies to adopt a new operating system. It's mission impossible. So now that I know this, if somebody came up with a new operating system for a computer, I would tell them they're nuts. It cannot be done. Meanwhile, two guys in a dorm room, they don't know that. You know, they don't know how hard it is. So they create a new operating system, and it's going to create this next personal computer standard. Well, that's a beautiful thing. My job is to find those two guys or two gals or gal and a guy in a garage and, you know, sink my teeth into them. That's what a venture capitalist does. But, wow, I know how hard it is.
Well, tell me about then, what's the profile of the person most likely to have a world-changing idea?
That person views the world as a glass half full. And like I said at the top of the show, is asking, wouldn't it be neat if?
Great.
Which is very different than asking, how can I make money?
Do they have a college degree?
It doesn't matter. Steve Jobs doesn't have a college degree. Steve Wozniak got a college degree after he created Apple. It really doesn't matter. You just want somebody who's smart and who will work hard, and, you know, if luck happens to them, they will run with it. That's what it takes.
Okay. I want to go back to a little bit more about what you've learned specifically about watching some of these ideas of the past develop into the world-changing ideas and products and services that we live with now. When we kind of go back in the pathology of them, right? We perform the autopsy of the successful idea now. Hang on for that. We'll come back to it. We're about an hour away from your questions for Guy Kawasaki. The new book is called Reality Check. And although it's kind of a great business book, obviously, for people who are looking at starting their own company and they're looking for a roadmap of how to succeed, there's this other quality, a little bit more of the mystical nature of ideas, and especially those that will change the world. We'll talk about that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Stay warm. This is Ian Punnett.